Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Thanks to the Friends of WILL, whose contributions have helped us maintain a strong program schedule in 2004. Your gifts support almost half our annual operating budget. If you appreciate the programs but haven't yet contributed, consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Write a check to the Friends of WILL Radio and mail it to the University of Illinois Foundation, Box 3429, Champaign, 61826. Thank you, and happy holidays.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, the topic in this hour is personal finance. It's something that we do monthly on the program, always on a Friday, and generally with the same guest, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at University of Illinois and has been stopping by here on a Friday for a long time to talk a little bit about the economy, to talk about investing strategies, and to answer your questions. And the way we start is he has a few comments to make, and he said he would just like to review some of the things that have happened in the economy over the last year or so. And if people have questions on that, or if you have specific sorts of questions about your own financial planning, you're confused about the options, you're not quite sure what's best, you can sample his opinions and you can put that into your mix that you're using to try to figure out what it is that you want to do with your own financial situation, no matter what it is you're thinking about. You're thinking about college for your kids, you're thinking about your retirement, anything that comes in between there, buying a house, whatever. We can do those kinds of questions. So with all of that, we'd say good morning, welcome back, glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. And also, I would like to take this opportunity, of course, to wish all of the WILL staff and listening audience, well, a very joyous, healthy, and peaceful holiday season. I believe it would be somewhat instructive to take a few minutes and review the ups and downs of the financial markets in 2004, as well as looking at a few year-end strategies to perhaps reduce income taxes, a review of your portfolio, perhaps repositioning it as well. First, let's take a quick look, a cursory look, at the stock market and particularly the various indices to which I periodically refer. Let's point out that, first of all, it was a pretty darn decent year to be in the stock market. So far, the S&P 500, for example, is up some 10% for the calendar year, if we also include the dividend return on the S&P 500. And recall that the S&P 500 really are the 500 largest companies on a market capitalized basis. The mid-caps, the next 500 big companies, well, they've even done better than the S&P. They're up some 19% as an asset class for the year. And what about those smaller companies often referred to as the Russell 2000? They've forged ahead at the towering pace of almost 19% as well. What about the high tech, sometimes referred to as the NASDAQ or the NASDAQ 100? How have those tech stocks fared in the year 2004? On balance, up well over 10%, almost 11% thus far through the calendar year. The large value sector, up 14%. The small value sector, really a banner area, up some 23%. And then there's just no question about it, the hot sector of the year, real estate. And more particularly, the REITs, the real estate investment trusts. Recall that REITs are actual securities. They're stocks. They are companies that not only own real estate, they invest in the real estate area. And, for example, the Vanguard REIT sector was up some 30% for the year, which includes not only capital gain or unrealized appreciation, but dividend income as well. Emerging markets up some 20%. Small companies all across the globe having a banner year as well. The European index, the Australia, the Far East, often referred to as the International or EFI index, up almost 14% for the year. And really, the trailing index were Japanese stocks, the Nikkei index, the big companies on the Nikkei, up some 3% for the year. Bottom line, just about wherever you positioned yourself this year, if you simply stepped up to the batter's box, put some money in the stock market, well, maybe you didn't hit home runs, but you hit a lot of singles, doubles, and triples, no question about it. Of course, it's only December 17th, so I don't want to speak too soon. December 31 is not too far away, but typically, the last couple of weeks of December often see some tax selling, which initially drives prices down just a bit, and then they usually rally into late December. So I think probably returns and people who hold stocks this year are going to be well cheered by their results. Well, let's take a few moments and look at rates of return and yields on various fixed income instruments. Now, a year ago, if you owned a six-month treasury, you were happy to earn 1%. That was about it. And your savings account probably was earning 0.5%. Today, if you go out and you actually purchase a treasury in the six-month area, you're going to be pushing close to 2.4 or 2.5% in terms of current yield. Interestingly enough, if you were a buyer of longer-term financial instruments, there really isn't a whole lot of difference between where you would have been a year ago and where you are today. For example, 10-year Treasury notes a year ago were yielding about 4.25%. Today, they're a little bit over 4%. Not much change. And again, in the long-term bonds a year ago, you might have earned as much as 5% if your timing was really spectacular. Today, the current yield would be about 4.7%. So it's very interesting. On the short end of the stick, interest rates are moving up. But when we look out at 10-year instruments, 15- and 20-year instruments, there hasn't been a whole lot of change over the last 12 months. And that's important to keep in mind because it has something to say about mortgage rates. And I think it's worthwhile to examine interest rates and their actual direction as well. So let's push a little bit further in this area. Let's talk for a moment about the prime rate. Now, the prime rate historically has been a rate at which creditworthy corporations have borrowed money from money center banks. And 1 year ago, the prime rate stood at 4%. And when I refer to the prime rate, I'm really talking about Wall Street prime, because it's quoted in the Wall Street Journal, so a lot of people refer to it as Wall Street prime. That was 4% 1 year ago. Today, it's 5.25%. The Fed funds rate 1 year ago, the target rate was about 1%. That's the rate at which banks borrow from each other overnight, just simply by computer, based upon their reserve requirements. Today, as a result of Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve, that rate has actually been pushed up 5 times thus far in calendar year 2004 by the Fed, quarter point moves each time, so the Fed funds rate is now about 2.25% as a target. And from all indications, the next Fed meeting is early February, and most economists and pundits agree that there's going to be at least one more 0.25% move up in February. So we would be looking at that Fed funds rate hitting 2.5% and Wall Street prime moving to 5.5%. Interestingly enough, while rates, as I mentioned, have moved dramatically on the short end of the stick, on the long end, when we look at mortgage rates, they haven't moved very much. For example, 1 year ago, a 30-year mortgage rate might have been in the mid-fives. Call it 5.5%. Yesterday, it was quoted at 5.3%. 15-year rates, around 5 a year ago. Today, pretty close to the same thing. So again, what we've seen is we've seen interest rates moving in shorter-term securities. Now, let's talk about the rate of inflation, a bit more troublesome. If we go back to December of 2003 and take a look back from there a year, 2002 to 2003, that December period of time, that rate of inflation was about 1.8%. If we take a look at inflation today and we look back approximately 12 months, December of 2003 to December of 2004, we just heard on NPR that that rate is approximating 3.7%. That's a doubling of the inflation rate from 1.8 to 3.7, more than double. Now, On a month-to-month basis, we heard that the consumer price index was up about 0.2% in November. Not a great move. And the Federal Reserve doesn't seem to be terribly concerned about inflation. We're reading each day that producers are trying to move some of these cost increases in raw materials onto the people who buy it. In other words, the producers are trying to push those cost increases onto us, we being the consumers. Now, something a bit troubling and something that I ran into personally as a result of my daughter studying abroad this semester in Granada, Spain, a year ago, if you wanted one of those fancy euros, that was $1.25 American. If you want one of those fancy euros today, that's going to cost you somewhere at least about $1.35 American. So that American currency a year ago was worth about 80% of a euro, and today it's worth less than 75%. Now, I can tell you firsthand that things are expensive in Europe to begin with, and then when you have this, great inflation, it used to be called currency inflation. I'm not sure what we ought to call it. Things are very, very expensive. And interestingly enough, you're reading a lot of information in the Wall Street and various financial periodicals that says U.S. is on sale. Because obviously, people who hold euros can come to the United States and they find bargains galore. I got a real chuckle out of a Wall Street Journal article of about a week and a half ago about people who work in Manhattan, downtown New Yorkers, who are complaining that they had to wait for lunch because all of these folks from Europe were coming in and just sitting at tables and eating at their lunchtime because it was so inexpensive compared to eating in Paris, for example, for lunch. And these downtown New Yorkers were missing their favorite tables. I feel so bad for them, David, and having to wait in line. Well, anyway, this dollar, well, we could call it a collapse, to me is especially troublesome. In large measure, economists blame the weak dollar on an escalating deficit, of course, and a horrific balance of payments deficit of some $50 billion per month. In other words, we are importing $50 billion more of goods each month than we are exporting. Now, some of that has to do with the price of oil, of course. Now, this trade deficit represents almost 6% of our gross domestic product. And economists estimate that this trade deficit really cuts about a half to three quarters of 1% off our overall annual growth rate. And that translates into jobs. So that has a dramatic impact on our economy. Also, foreign governments and foreign corporations hold much of our U.S. Treasury instruments, which we issue, of course, to fund our annual budget deficit. And the foreign holders are kind of getting unhappy. When they cash their treasuries in and they convert them and they get them American dollars and then they convert them again back over to euros, and guess what? They're losing money because of the impact of the relationship between dollars and euros. So in order to entice foreign entities to continue to hold our treasuries and essentially fund a good deal of our deficit, the interest rates paid will have to be a bit more enticing. So if someone put a gun to my head and said, what's the direction of interest rates? I say that's a simple question. Either up, down, or it stays the same. But there are some good arguments to be made that at least on the short-term interest rate scale, on the short side of maturities, that interest rates are going to continue to trend up. So for that reason alone, because of our European friends and governments who are buying our treasuries, they're going to be demanding a little bit better return, and that would translate into a little bit higher interest rate. Now, okay, we're armed with a whole bunch of information. What are we going to do with it? Are there any prudent steps that we can take today? Well, first of all, for those of you with variable interest rate mortgages who are not planning to move in the next 3 to 5 years, it's not too late to lock in a 15-year or 30-year mortgage rate. And that 3 to 5 years passes pretty darn quickly. If you know you're going to move and you're into a variable mortgage rate, okay. But otherwise, I really strongly recommend looking at a 15 or 30-year rate. Of course, variable rates can move as much as 2 full percentage points each year and generally can move up a maximum of 6% over the life of a loan. And these kinds of interest rate moves, if they would occur, could certainly be debilitating to your financial health. Second, re-examine your stock portfolio to determine if you are represented by all of these major stock asset classes, from big stocks to small stocks, from value to growth, to U.S. to international. If not, let's reposition your portfolio, and I would suggest after the first of the year. I recommend waiting until the first of the year, especially in the case of mutual funds, so you don't run into this old tax trap of funds in the last 2 weeks of December paying a dividend and you're being taxed on that dividend, but the actual value of the fund decreases, so your portfolio really stays the same. Of course, keep in mind that you can reposition funds anytime with no tax impact, so long as these funds are part of a tax-deferred portfolio, such as an IRA, a 401k, a 403b. Third, many portfolio managers are now suggesting that in the case of a balanced portfolio, let's say that you're 50% in stocks and 50% in fixed income, there is a clear tax advantage to holding the stock portion in non-tax qualified accounts and holding the fixed income portion inside your IRAs, your 401ks, your profit sharing plans, etc. That's because of a very favorable 15% capital gains tax rate at the federal level on securities held for at least 1 year. Let me give you a simple example. In fact, maybe you might even want to write this down, take out a pencil and paper. Here's the simple example. Let's assume that you have a $200,000 overall portfolio. And $100,000 is in stock indexes, for example, and $100,000 is invested in treasury notes. Something real simple, 50-50 asset allocation. And let's further assume that the $100,000 in stock indexes is in your 401k, and the $100,000 in treasuries is simply in a brokerage account titled in your name. And over the next 10 years, the stock portfolio appreciates to $200,000. And then you start taking your money out of your IRA, your 403b, your 401k that's loaded up with this appreciation of stocks. Remember that any time that you pull money out of one of these tax-deferred areas, those dollars are going to be taxed at your highest marginal rate. And that highest marginal rate could be as high as 35%. On the other hand, if you had that $100,000 of stocks in a non-tax-deferred account, it was just sitting in a simple after-tax brokerage account, the $100,000 grew to $200,000, and then you sold those positions, you would realize $100,000 of capital gain. And at least under current law federally, that gain would be taxed at a maximum rate of only 15%. That's an enormous difference. That's a 20% difference. And when we translate that into money, that could be as much as $20,000. So it's a very, very substantial amount. So take a look at the alternatives of holding some equity positions in after-tax accounts. And really, that means that you need to consult with your tax advisor, perhaps your financial planner as well. So that's the bottom line. It's not too late to visit with a financial advisor, with a planner before the end of the year. They're around. Trust me, they are around. They're happy to take your call, and you might ask about some of these issues. So there you have it, David, sort of a little bit of a review, and I'd be delighted to visit further about the issues I've raised or, of course, tackle any questions from our listeners.
All right. We have someone waiting, and others, if you'd like to call, the number is 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. And we'll start with Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad you began the morning with the issues of various rates of returns on different investments. For a while now, I've been debating with friends a question, and I'm hoping you could help us determine how to figure the rate of return on an investment accurately. And there are two parts, if I may. One is real estate, the simple question of at what point should you pay off your mortgage? If you come into a small inheritance and you lucky enough to be near the end of the life of a mortgage, and you say, what do I do with this inheritance? And you begin looking at the performance of REITs in the years past, stocks, bonds, whatever. And it is troublesome that you can't tell the year ahead that you're going to invest in, but only the year past. What you can tell, however, is what will happen if you pay off the mortgage, because you can calculate how much you pay per month to the mortgage holder. And you can calculate, in this next year, since I won't pay that, that'll stay with me. Will that accurately reflect the rate of return on your investment? Can you say that the money you don't pay in the next year is your return, and then calculate the rate based on how much money you're paying off?
Well, you're close. One of the questions that you want to ask yourself is, are you itemizing on your tax return? In other words, is that interest being itemized? So in your case, are you still on the air?
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Okay. Is your interest being itemized?
No.
Okay. So you're not getting any tax benefit.
That's right. That's
so if your mortgage is a 5% mortgage, a 6% mortgage.
It's 6.
All right. Well, then the truth of the matter is that on the unpaid principal, even though it's amortizing on a monthly basis, we take 6 divided by 12, and your monthly amortized interest rate is 0.5.
Right.
All right? And if we multiply that times 12, that's 6%. And if you pay that off, then you're not faced with that, and you get the added benefit of not only paying yourself at the rate of 6%, you have paid off the remaining principal payments, so you have increased your cash flow.
That's right.
And that's a free tax cash flow, because you're not going to be paying taxes on that principal.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, you now have additional funds to dollar cost average or reposition into some alternative investments.
But does that additional cash count as a return? Because I was doing the bizarre math. If I paid off the last $20,000, and during the course of the year I would not have to pay the roughly $7,000 that I ordinarily pay to the mortgage holder.
Yes.
Am I getting a 30% return on my $20,000 investment?
No.
Oh.
No.
Sounded
no.
Good.
No, that's too good to be true.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, it was. No, that isn't the way we figure it. No, what we have to look at is the interest rate, because it's simply a repayment of principal back to yourself.
So 6% in today's...
it's a pretty decent return with no risk.
I mean, the bonds will tell you what you absolutely will get for the mm-hmm. next year, and none of them has approached 6.
No, and you got to hold that bond for the year.
Oh, yeah.
You got to hold it. You can't be a trader. So you are earning a 6% riskless return by paying off that mortgage.
Return at that.
Yep, it's an after-tax riskless 6% return.
Well, I'm sorry to hear it. That 30% looked awfully good for a moment.
Now, is this a rental property?
Yeah.
Okay. So you are taking advantage of depreciation deductions, et cetera.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
The laws are so skewed. In any event, the second issue.
Yes.
Is how to determine rate of return on an investment retrospectively. Is that allowed? Because though you've just given us some great returns for the 12 months preceding, if you begin at when you went into the stock market, and it happened to be 1999,
yes,
buoyed up,
yes,
by exuberance,
yes,
you remember that one.
I remember that very well.
Yeah, I'm not exactly back where I started, 14, 15, or even 30%. For this last year, notwithstanding.
Well, that's probably because you were a little too heavily invested in some of those runaway tech areas, originally in 1999. Interestingly,
there's no way of accurately reflecting what my return has been.
There is.
I'm not even back to where I started.
No, there is an accurate way to do that. And if you would go out and buy yourself, and maybe you already have one if you're a real estate investor, you could spend about $30, and I think it's a wonderful investment. It's a Texas Instrument BA 2 Plus calculator.
Okay.
It's a TI BA 2 Plus calculator, and it actually comes with a book of instructions that, one, is readable, two, discernible, and three, you can figure out.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And what you could do is you could take the series of investment dollars that you put into your portfolio, even if these dollars occurred at different points in time, and you could put those in as essentially cash payments. You could put in the number of years that you've been involved in this for, and you could take your current portfolio as essentially the future value. And again, this is all explained inside the little booklet. And you could compute what's called the interest rate, the rate of return, over the life of your investments. You could do this individually for each investment. You could do it as a totality.
Yeah. So it integrates and reiterates year by year and sums up any funds added year by year.
You can do that as long as you have those series of cash flows.
Yeah.
And you probably could figure that out.
We avoid the Beardtown lady problem.
Exactly.
That was a shock.
That was
all
a bit of a shock.
Well, I was hoping for that 30% return. That was good for a moment.
Well, if you could find that, let me know. Okay? Because I want to be part of that party.
Well, like the Beardtown lady, you can fool yourself into thinking that's what you're getting if you want to look at it in a certain way. That's why standard practices are decided on, so people can't decide for themselves how to look at it and how to fudge the numbers.
Well, that's right, and there's something called AMR standards, and most professional money managers, investment advisors, and banks report returns based upon something called AMR standards. If you go to the internet and do a Google search under AMR, you'll find how those rates of return are intelligently calculated.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I thank the last caller. We have several other people holding we want to get on to. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance at the U of I College of Business. He is here once a month, almost on a Friday in the 10 o'clock hour, and we talk about investing and money management. And if you have specific questions about your own situation, you are invited to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Oak Forest, and that's line number 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hi. In the Chicago Tribune this month, there was a discussion of the $3.8 trillion in government securities and $400 billion federal deficit, and I'd just like to read you a sentence from that. Greenspan was signaling that there could be a devastating plunge in the value of the dollar rather than just a gradual slide because we continue to consume and borrow beyond our means and also run a huge federal deficit. There's another reason, too. The Chinese, Japanese, and other Asian countries have rigged the currency market to their own economic ends. So, in light of that, what's your opinion of investments today?
Well, I think I've heard this before. We hear this periodically, and I'm a great believer that things ultimately regress to the mean. And I think things are a little bit out of kilter. Now, there is no question that it is extraordinarily troublesome that we have this enormous deficit, and we have an enormous balance of trades deficit. And I think what Alan Greenspan is doing and what the Federal Reserve is doing is they are slowly ratcheting up interest rates so that at least in the short run that foreign governments and foreign corporations will continue to fund our requirements for our economy. But at the same time, as this is taking place, our economy seems, and I say seems, to be recovering. There have been a number of articles, especially at the state level, where most states are seeing better state budgets, better income from state revenues, et cetera. So we do have an economy that is, one, expanding, and two, recovering, and ultimately some of that is going to offset this impact. But unquestionably, we can't continue to run up these enormous deficits forever, where we're talking in the range of $400 to $500 billion a year, because that is just going to force interest rates higher, or otherwise our dollar will continue to plunge. So it is troublesome, but I think in the long run, in the big picture, I think things will turn around. In the short run, I think it's entirely possible that the currency relationship could even grow more. Well, let's call it, it would grow worse.
Well, what if it happened that it grew worse, things there was the economic recovery didn't take place, or raising interest rates didn't help. What would be a safe place to put your money?
Though? Well, let's think about this for a moment. If our currency continues to depreciate, what is really happening here? American goods are on sale. That's really what's happening. So many, many companies are actually benefiting by this relationship, especially companies who are producing large manufactured types of items and goods such as Caterpillar, who are shipping enormous amounts of vehicles, trucks, heavy equipment abroad. They're showing record profits. So this is not all a dark picture because, again, in the short run, this is really boosting the voracious appetite of foreigners for our products as well. Now, where to invest? Well, I think one of the questions that you're really asking is, how is this going to impact inflation? Because the value of our dollar, if, for example, if the consumer price index over the last 12 months is up 3.8%, and I'm earning 3 or 4% and I'm paying tax on that to boot, I'm actually delta negative. So I've come back to the fact that I still firmly believe that we have to look at a long-term strategy. And you just cannot get hung up in investing money for a year, 2 years, even 3 years. If you need access to that money, then you've got to stay very, very short. And you're looking at short-term securities, be they CDs or short-term treasuries. Alternatively, if you have a longer-term horizon and can deal with some volatility, then a percentage of that portfolio needs to be across these broad asset classes. I continue to believe that. That's how I invest my money personally. So I'm only preaching how I invest my own money.
Well, I guess I'm concerned because I don't see Alan Greenspan giving out warnings like this without a lot of reason, because everything he says is, you know, micromanaged by the media, the financial institutions, et cetera. So he doesn't say these things lightly, and I think that's why I feel I need to be more conservative.
Well, there's nothing wrong with being more conservative at any time. But just remember that people who become too conservative, because these moves in the stock market, they happen very, very quickly. As I was remarking off the air, the major moves in the stock market this year have been post-Bush election, good or bad. I don't make any comment about that, but that is the bottom line. And if people pulled out of the markets before that, they essentially lost the major, major gains seen in the stock market. So if one is going to be in the stock market, one needs to be broadly allocated across all of these asset allocations, all of these asset classes, and at the same time be willing to sit in the market, because there can be these short periods of time where there are major moves up, and it's just unfortunate when people miss them.
Okay, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Let's go to a caller here next in Terre Haute, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Could you tell me, if I want to give some stock to my adult children,
yes,
could you tell me the best way to handle the taxes on that? Should they do that when they're ready to sell it, or do I need to do that now?
Well, first of all, there are a couple of rules that you need to be made aware of. The first rule is that you as an individual have what's called the annual gift exclusion. And that gift exclusion means that you can gift up to $11,000, whether it's cash, stocks, real estate, to as many people as you want annually. And there is no tax on that distribution either to you or to the recipient. That's rule number one. So if you were married, for example, you could give $22,000 to David Inge, myself, and my daughters Renee and Megan, that you would be covered under the annual gift exclusion. Now, when people gift stock to related parties, for example, children, now the children, let's say that you give $10,000 of IBM stock. Here's how it works. They have to determine what their basis is in that gift. And the basis is the lower of the price at the time that you gifted the stock or your basis in the stock. What does that really mean? And let me see if I can simplify that for you.
So it's the lower of those.
Lower. So let's say that you are gifting $10,000 of IBM stock. Mm-hmm. Today it's worth $10,000 and you call your broker, say, broker, transfer this to my child's account. You've made a $10,000 gift. All right? No tax. No gift tax, no nothing tax at that point in time. However, your child must determine what is his or her basis in that position so that when they sell the position, they will know whether or not any tax is owing. Let's say that you bought that stock and you paid $5,000 for it, right?
Right.
You've now transferred it to your child. Your child's tax basis is the lower of the fair market value or your basis, which in this case would be $5,000. So now they own a $10,000 position. Their stock tax basis is $5,000. They hold that position, let's say, for a couple of years. And maybe the stock goes to $15,000. They then sell the position. They would have a $10,000 capital gain. And under federal law, at least today, they would pay a 15% capital gains tax on the gain only. So if it was a $10,000 gain altogether, that would be $1,500 to the federal government. And you're calling from which state?
Indiana.
All right. And if your children, let's say, are residents of the state of Indiana, they would also pay Indiana income tax on that gain as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Mm-hmm. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month, he's here on the program. We talk about money management, and questions are welcome. We have two ready to go. We might get one more at least, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the next caller up is White Heath. That's line three. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I have a parent, a father, who is day trades on the stock market, and he has a pretty bearish look on the future, and he's used the word stagflation with me, and I'm curious about if you could explain that for me and what you think the possibility of stagflation is.
Well, stagflation is where the economy isn't growing, there's massive unemployment, and things are getting more expensive by the day. That's stagflation in a nutshell. It's called inflation without any growth. It often comes as a result of rapid increases in commodity prices. And a lot of folks are arguing that we have reached sort of a pinnacle right now in these commodity prices. Now, oil seems to be moving back up again. It was down to $40 a barrel. We're pushing $45 again. But this would suggest stagflation, that you have continued rapid increases in commodities, especially at the wholesale level, leading to more expensive goods in order to purchase them. That's inflation. And at the same time, no meaningful growth in the economy. The GDP not growing. Unemployment increasing. And right now, at least based upon employment reports, the numbers of people who are finding jobs, even from employers themselves, all pointing toward January and February being periods of time where more workers are going to be hired, more workers are going to be employed. So I really don't see the stagflation scenario happening at the moment. Could it happen? Sure. I'm not a prognosticator. But just based upon the indicators that I'm looking at right now, I'm not terribly worried about that. Now, what I am interested to hear is you mentioned that your father is a day trader.
Yes.
Wow. What does he trade? Does he trade futures or options or just stocks?
Well,
that's impressive.
Well, it's I don't think I'm the best person to explain what he does since I don't understand most of it. But I know he believes and is heavily invested in gold stocks right now. And he just researches individual stocks and watches them and looks at charts and goes from there. So he's skeptic about the economy right now and things like that. So he's making a lot of those choices.
Okay. And that makes sense, because if you are skeptical about the economy and you believe in stagflation, you would be looking to put your money into hard assets. And one of the easiest ways to put money into hard assets, as opposed to owning gold and silver, which is difficult to store and difficult to deal with, is you own gold and silver stocks, the companies that actually mine this stuff. And what you find out is that when gold goes up, these gold stocks actually go up by a greater factor than the price of an ounce of gold. So he probably is in various sectors of hard commodities. Maybe it's oil, maybe it's gold, maybe it's silver, et cetera.
I know he's a natural gas.
Sure. So he's betting that we're going to see substantial increases at the wholesale and commodities level, leading to greater inflation, and at the same time, our economy is going to get stuck. So that's his bet, and I'm not agreeing and or disagreeing, but at least if that's his belief based upon his research, then he's acting on his belief and research, and he should be applauded for that.
Sure. Can I just follow up with one question?
Sure.
For myself, my husband and I are thinking about a small business and a commercial loan. And, you know, when I talk about this issue with my father, and the fact of the matter is lenders generally don't lend for more than 5 years.
That's correct.
Fixed rate.
3 to 5.
You know, he kind of, his eyes get real big, like, well, be prepared for interest rates in the teens in 5 years. I mean, he's not saying that it is going to happen. He's also not a prognosticator, but, you know, we're in a rising market for rates, so it makes me a little nervous to hear him be so bearish when I'm thinking about my future and borrowing a significant amount of money.
Well, when you borrow a significant amount of money for a commercial business, keep in mind that you may be able to lock in a rate for as long as 3 years. Often it may be a floating rate. And as an alternative, you may be able to procure an SBA loan.
Yes.
So that would be the route that I would look at, because then you could lock in an interest rate. Even though it may be initially higher in the long run, it may be a wiser move. And there are any number of good SBA lenders at various banks that you could talk to, even in Champaign County.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your help.
All right.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. Next up is Muhammad. Caller here is on line number one. Hello. Yeah.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I have a question about financial advisor. I'm in the process of looking to change my financial advisor, or perhaps learn that I don't really need one. And I'm looking for someone who is independent of a brokerage or independent of selling particular products. I want someone who can give me independent information about how I should be handling my assets. How do I go about doing that?
Well, probably you're looking for a fee-only advisor.
A what? A
fee-only.
Yeah.
In other words, you want to just retain someone to sit down with you on an hourly basis and give you advice and not sell any products.
That's right.
And very interestingly, in the financial services industry as a whole, there are about 4 to 5% of people who are fee-only financial advisors.
Well, looking through the yellow pages, I don't find things that indicate that.
Well, actually, you're probably looking for a certified financial planner, a CFP.
Yeah, okay.
And the question that you want to ask is, are you a fee-only advisor?
Okay.
Because that's what I'm looking for.
The person I'm dealing with now and have for a number of years is a CFP, but he has a direct tie to a particular product.
Okay. So that is very typical. That's a fee/commission advisor.
Uh-huh.
And while that person may be extraordinarily talented, I find it difficult just personally, from a perspective of conflicts of interest, to be advising on one hand and selling products on another.
I just
feel it's difficult.
Yes.
But there are many, many wonderful financial advisors who can do both.
Okay.
For me, it would just be pretty darn difficult. So you can go to the International Board of Standards for Certified Financial Planners. It's called the IBCFP website. IBCFP. Yes, IBCFP. If you do a quick Google search, you'll come up with it. And they have a registry. They have the registry of certified financial planners who are fee only. And you could list them, whether they're all in Illinois, Indiana, by state. So you can come up with these folks, and then you could actually talk to one by phone to see if the chemistry is worthwhile, and maybe you would want to schedule an appointment with one of these individuals.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Hope that helps you out.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you.
All right. My pleasure.
Very good. And again, we'll go to another caller. This is Champagne, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I just have a quick question. My dad is like a senior citizen, over 90 and so on. He has a house that he bought earlier, which has been fully paid off, so there is no mortgage on it. It has been depreciated completely. And in case he sells it, he might have a little capital gain, not too much, but maybe like $20,000-$30,000 or so. And my question to you is that at his age, is 92 plus over and so on, you know, depending on the tax situation, if he wants to give that to me or to someone else, what would be the rules on that one? I know you talked about the gift exclusion clause for $11,000 per year, per person, per, you know, whoever he wants. But if he wants to gift the entire thing at one time, would that be a good move from the capital point of view?
Probably not.
Okay.
Now, let me understand something.
Sure.
This is your father's personal residence?
No, it's not his personal residence. It was his personal residence, but now he's staying with me. I built my own residence.
I see. So he has essentially turned this into an income property where it is now getting depreciated?
No, actually, no. Even when he lived there and all those things, it was done. It is a vacant property. It is not bringing any income.
Okay.
Just sitting there.
All right. But essentially, it has been his personal residence.
For a long, long time.
For a long, long period of time.
That's correct.
So if he sells the personal residence outright,
right,
he probably is able to take advantage of a capital gains rule that basically says that if I have lived in this residence for two consecutive years and treated it as my personal residence,
right,
I can then have a capital gain of up to $250,000 and owe no tax.
That is correct.
Okay. So if he sold the residence and you exercised that capital gains exclusion, now he's sitting on cash. At that point in time, he has the opportunity to gift the cash directly to you with no tax impact under two different rules. The first is the annual gift exclusion, which is $11,000 per year, but he also has a lifetime exclusion, which is an offset against a federal estate tax credit, and that lifetime exclusion is up to $1 million. So let's say this house was worth $100,000. Mm-hmm. He could gift the whole thing to you in cash. He's paid no tax on the sale. He's gifted the cash to you, and there is no gift tax because he is using up part of his lifetime gift exclusion.
So no gift tax to him or to me?
Neither.
To neither.
The gift tax is always a tax on the donor. On the giver of the gift, not the recipient. So if you did it in that way, and if you indeed have explained the facts correctly to me, then I would caution you to check with your tax advisor.
Right.
I believe that's what you could do, and as a result, there would be no taxes owing.
The only thing is the slight twist to the scenario that we talked about is that you mentioned that you have to live there 2 out of 5 years. But the thing is that the house is vacant. It's kind of abandoned. Nobody is living there in the last 2 out of 5 years.
Okay.
Lived there 20 years, but let's say for 3 years, nobody lived there.
Okay.
And it's vacant, empty, and literally, technically abandoned.
Okay.
In that case,
Then it may be that if you sell and he does have a capital gain, mm-hmm, he may be at such a low tax rate that the capital gains tax rate may not be 15. If it's a personal residence, he might be in a very low capital gains tax rate, especially since he hasn't depreciated the property.
I see.
But I think he's going to be better off selling it himself as opposed to gifting it to you, because I'm guessing you're in a higher rate.
Yes.
That would be my guess. But I would check with my tax counsel first. But I'm almost certain that that will be the best provision. Now, something else. It's not good to have a vacant house.
Right.
That's because after 60 days, your insurance company might balk at insuring the house, and if there is a claim, right, paying the claim.
I understand.
All right, you understand.
Right, there's that. But the thing, second question I have is then, in this scenario, can that lifetime exclusion not be, you know, applicable? Let's say he sells it, but it's much less than that. The limit is $250,000.
Well, whatever cash he gives you, right, be above and beyond $11,000 annually, mm-hmm, that's a subtraction from the lifetime gift exclusion of $1 million.
Yeah, so let's say we're talking only of $50,000 or so.
Yeah, no tax. No tax.
How can I get more information on this Lifetime Exclusion Act? Is there any publication, IRS? Or something?
Well, I think you could just simply do a Google search very, very quickly on the Internet and look at personal real estate exclusions. You could plug in almost anything and you'll get to it.
I see.
For the lifetime exclusion, you could just plug in gift, lifetime exclusion, estate tax law, any number of ways to get to it.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, we are just about the point where we're going to have to stop here for this time around. Any last thing that you'd like to mention here before we go?
Well, no, I think it's a great time to think of making gifts. It's that time of year. And typically when you make gifts, you are better off making gifts of cash if you're going to do this to relatives, as opposed to gifts of appreciated property, because their tax basis will be at the lower number, as we talked about, and then if this second individual sells, they'd be faced with a capital gain. So it's generally better off to give gifts of appreciated property to charities, for example, because charities don't pay capital gains tax.
Okay. Well, our guest, David Sinnoh, he's clinical professor of finance at U of I. He's here each month to talk about money management, and we appreciate it very much.
David, it's always a pleasure, and it's just great fun for me personally, intellectually challenging. We just have such sophisticated listeners and questioners. As I say, it's just a privilege to be here with you.
Very good. Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The show also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates. This year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary, Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign, Urbana since 1982. Later today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn has a conversation with a woman who, faced with serious illness, found comfort and peace in the process of writing poetry and letters, and by doing something that she calls inner listening. Her name is Margaret Micas, and she'll be talking with Celeste in the 1 o'clock hour. Also, a little bit later in the program, she'll be talking with historian Stanley Weintraub about George Washington's Christmas farewell to his troops. The Afternoon Magazine gets underway at noon. Also, there'll be weather with Scott Althoff at 12:35 and an opportunity to call in and get a forecast for your travel destinations, all part of the Afternoon Magazine getting underway here at noon on AM 580. In the next hour, we'll be talking about Russia. Our guest will be Diane Conker. She's professor of history from U of I. Before that, though, we'll have news and update on the market, so please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The Center